I next met with Dr. Nasser Hanna, and to begin, he presented a patient from his practice.
So a 55-year-old female, very active, very few, if any, prior medical problems, lifelong never smoker, who presented with symptoms of cough, and she went to her doctor, got an x-ray, and lo and behold, she had a lung mass, she had mediastinal lymphadenopathy, and she had bone metastases. So like all non-smokers, you wonder if she has a adenocarcinoma that's driven by an activating mutation. So a biopsy confirmed adenocarcinoma, and her tumor was indeed assessed for EGFR mutations or ALK gene rearrangements, and neither of those was discovered. So she was started on carboplatin and pemetrexed, and after four cycles of therapy, she did have a partial response. So we decided to offer her maintenance pemetrexed, and she maintained on that every 3 or 4 weeks for about a year's time. Eventually, she did develop progression of disease. She was still feeling very well. Because she was a never smoker and had adenocarcinoma, I wanted to re-biopsy her for the purpose of checking her for a ROS1 gene rearrangement, something we weren't able to do on her original biopsy. So she agreed to undergo a repeat biopsy, and in addition to checking for ROS1, we decided to recheck for EGFR and ALK, even though they were checked the first time and found to be wild type. And we did discover that despite being wild type at baseline, she did harbor an ALK gene rearrangement on the rebiopsy. So therefore, we treated her with crizotinib, and she has maintained on that orally. She's tolerating it very well. She continues to work full time, and she's been on that for about a year's time, and she achieved another partial response.
Can you talk a little bit about how she did on the crizotinib in terms of side effects? Did she have any visual changes or anything whatsoever?
Her side effects were pretty representative of most of my patients, and that's that they usually have very minimal side effects. Those that do have side effects will tell you they have a little bit of nausea. They may experience some diarrhea, and that is dose-related. And then these patients do get this visual disturbance, and it's oftentimes manifested when they're driving at nighttime. They get this stream of lights phenomena, sort of like when you stare at the sun or you stare at a light in a dark room and then close your eyes and move your head around and you see a stream of lights. It's usually not a serious side effect, but if you query them, most patients will admit to that. And I always warn my patients because if they do night driving, it might catch them off guard.
This lady, did she have it? When did she have it? When do you typically see it? And does it go away?
Well, in my patients, it doesn't seem to go away. And again, it's usually not terribly disturbing for them. And it is most oftentimes manifested at nighttime when they're driving. But, you know, if they're in their home and they turn the lights off and, you know, suddenly the change in lights that can cause these stream of lights, I always tell them to be careful. But it's kind of an interesting side effect. It's thought to be related to the fact that the ALK gene seems to be involved in the development of the ocular pathways in the brain.
Interesting.
I don't think it's very well worked out, but it seems to have some sort of role in the ocular pathways.
So this case brings up a number of points, and the first is a very obvious one in terms of testing for ALK. What's your explanation about what happened here? What kind of test did you have originally? How was it done the second time? And how do you explain the discrepancy?
Yeah, well, you know, there are three ways you can test for this. You can do it by immunohistochemistry. That's not an FDA-approved method. It's not validated at this point. Although the early data with looking at immunohistochemistry, particularly if you're 2+, 3+, or 0, correlates pretty well with ALK positive by FISH, which is the gold standard. So if you're 2+ or 3+, you're almost always ALK FISH positive. If you're 0, you're ALK FISH negative. And 1+ is you're more likely to be negative, but there are a few positives. Having said that, that's a reasonable way to screen patients before you do FISH. We don't do that, but others use that as a screen on all their patients. FISH, looking for an ALK gene rearrangement, is the gold standard. You can do PCR, but you may miss the fusion partner, and there are multiple partners with ALK. EML4 is the most common partner with ALK, but there are others. So right now, FISH is the gold standard. And how do you explain that? There are multiple potential explanations. One may be a tumor heterogeneity. In other words, within the same tumor, you may have different molecular profiles. You may have a discrepancy between one area of metastases versus another, a MET versus a primary. And of course, you might have a change of disease over time. So you may not appreciate it in a dominant population at the time of diagnosis. You treat the patients with a certain therapy. And at the time of disease progression, the dominant population that you biopsy may have a different genetic profile. And there's always the possibility of a false negative with your original biopsy. So any of these are potential explanations. But I think the take-home point here is that never smokers or light remote smokers with adenocarcinomas are very likely to have some actionable mutation, whether it's EGFR, ALK, ROS1, sometimes RAF, HER2 mutations, and a number of others that are emerging that I would encourage people to look for these. And if they don't find them the first time, and you can easily access tumor at the time of disease progression, look again, because you may find it the second time.
Now, this lady both times had FISH?
She did. She had the same test, the same lab.
What about next generation sequencing?
That's a good question. You know, there are several platforms for that. Foundation One is the most commonly used platform, but there are others. Paradigm is one that we use that was developed at the University of Michigan. Caris is one that's used. And each of these claims some strengths versus the other. Foundation One has suggested that they find more ALK abnormalities than maybe some of the other platforms. There are no head-to-head comparisons. I think it's interesting that one platform may be better at detecting more of these ALK changes or EGFR mutations. But at this point, it's hard to know. But it is a possible bias of some of our results.
You know, there seems like there's a lot of controversy about, you know, the issue of multiplex testing, next-generation sequencing early. Because I've heard about cases supposedly that were negative on FISH who responded and they had ALK changes with next-gen sequencing. I've heard people say if you have a non-smoker who tests negative for EGFR and ALK, to just send it for next-gen sequencing. Do you agree with that?
I don't think that's unreasonable at all. And, you know, another reason to do it is you may find things other than ALK. I mean, obviously, you're going to sequence for many different things. So if it can get paid for, and that's sometimes still a challenge for our patients, I think if your suspicion is high enough, you should definitely do that. And I've had a number of patients, such as the one we just described, in which that did pay off for us. And she's doing very well. She may have done well with second-line chemotherapy, but the bottom line is, in first-line and in second-line trials, comparing targeted agents versus chemotherapy, whether it's EGFR or ALK, the targeted therapy is more active than chemotherapy.
It's interesting, though, that she did respond to carbo-PEM, and I have heard it said that the ALK tumors maybe are more sensitive to PEM, although I'm not sure. Is that your belief?
Well, that's the suggestion, but as you know, Dr. Mock and colleagues at ASCO last year did a head-to-head comparison of crizotinib versus pemetrexed and cisplatin in the first-line setting for patients who had ALK gene rearrangements. And the patients receiving crizotinib had a substantially higher response rate and progression-free survival. So while it may be, or maybe not, we don't know for sure, more active, you know, chemo, particularly pemetrexed, may be more active as well. Most people think that's true. It's still not as active as the targeted agent.
I'm curious what your thoughts are about the next generation of ALK inhibitors. Of course, we have ceritinib now approved. If this lady were to develop disease progression, you know, let's say on imaging, for example, would you be thinking about ceritinib? Do you think that there may be a time when ceritinib is going to be moving up front? Where do you see that heading?
Yeah, without a doubt, ceritinib is specifically FDA approved in patients with ALK gene rearrangements who have previously received crizotinib and either been intolerant of it or had disease progression. So that would definitely be the treatment of choice, in my view, for her when she eventually does have disease progression. Ceritinib has been tested in both crizotinib naive as well as patients who've previously received crizotinib. It's very active in both settings with response rates between 50 and 60%. So you would logically think that saritinib would be a more effective ALK inhibitor than crizotinib, since it is so active in patients who have crizotinib failure. But we need to do those head-to-head comparisons. I think that is important. The other thing is most people would say, and I think this is true, that saritinib is a much more potent ALK inhibitor than crizotinib. Crizotinib is an extremely potent MET inhibitor, not nearly as good of an ALK inhibitor. And then the other issue is, what about ROS1? It looks like crizotinib is probably a better ROS1 drug than saritinib. So there are these nuances with these drugs, and it's not one size fits all. It kind of gets me back to another story with EGFR inhibitors. And, you know, we treat patients with erlotinib or afatinib if they have an activating EGFR mutation, and we sort of lump all EGFR activating mutations together. But there appears to be a picture that's emerging that exon 19 and L858R are different, and their responsiveness is a little bit different. They're different prognostically as well. And I'm sure it will be found that there are probably differences with ALK as well and ROS1.
Another question about saritinib. I'm curious what your experience is in terms of tolerability. I've heard people say that maybe the dose is too high or there are GI problems. Have you seen that?
I have. Saritinib can be a tough drug. Again, like crizotinib, it is dose-related. It does cause a lot of nausea, and it can cause a lot of GI distress, diarrhea. That is the dominant day-to-day side effect of that drug. If you hold the drug for 2 or 3 days, the nausea goes away. I've had patients who've had a great deal of difficulty tolerating it, but we've been able to dose reduce them and get them on antiemetics. And because the drug works so well in these patients, they plug away and they stay on it. But that is definitely the dominant side effect of the drug, at least in my experience.
So one final issue with this case I wanted to ask you about is I noticed that initially when you thought she was wild type, she got carbo and PEM and then PEM maintenance and no BEV. Was she eligible for BEV? And if so, why did you not use it?
She was BEV eligible, and that's a great question. There's nothing wrong with having given her BEV, and some people would have treated her with carboplatin plus pemetrexed plus bevacizumab, and then the issue of maintenance, PEM alone, BEV alone, or PEM-BEV alone. Others would have given the Sandler regimen of carbo, paclitaxel, and BEV, followed by maintenance BEV. There have been a number of randomized trials that have tried to address what the optimal induction therapy is, what the optimal maintenance therapy is. My view of all this is that they all look fairly comparable. The almost completed ECOG trial, I think, will be very informative in this regard. This is a trial where everyone gets the same induction therapy of carboplatin, paclitaxel, and bevacizumab, and then they're randomized to one of three arms, either maintenance bevacizumab, maintenance pemetrexed, or maintenance pemetrexed plus bevacizumab. That's the cleanest study that we're going to get. We'll probably see those results in a year or so. Until that time, I think these are all reasonable options. There was a trial by Zinner and colleagues that looked at carbo, paclitaxel, BEV versus carbo, PEM, BEV. The paclitaxel arm got maintenance BEV. The carbo, PEM, BEV arm got PEM, BEV. So it was essentially comparing the two most commonly used strategies. And to me, those survival curves looked overlapping. So I give most of my patients carbo PEM followed by maintenance PEM, and that is evidence-based. The Paramount trial treated patients in that case with cisplatin and PEM times 4, and then if they hadn't progressed, they were randomized to maintenance PEM or not. And there was a survival, not just a progression-free survival, but an overall survival advantage for maintenance PEM. So my practice is modeled mostly after that trial.
So let's go on to your 44-year-old lady who I think supports the point that we've seen maybe the biggest change to happen in the field of oncology in a long, long, long time, the approval of an anti-PD-1 agent in lung cancer. I'm really curious what your thoughts are about how that's going to play out, and seems like this 44-year-old lady is a good example.
I agree. I would tell you that, you know, lung cancer doctors, by and large, tend to be more on the understated side. They don't tend to proclaim these huge advances. I think we can all agree that things like crizotinib and erlotinib are major, major advances. But, you know, the role of chemotherapy in metastatic disease, second-line therapy, even adjuvant therapy or inclusion of chemotherapy for stage 3 patients when you have radiation, all of these are advances, but we have to all agree that these are modest advances. This data with nivolumab as second-line therapy for squamous cell, it changes everything. In my 15 years of taking care of patients with lung cancer, this to me is the biggest difference maker that I've seen yet. And that comes from the results of this trial, but also my personal experience. We're used to seeing our advances come in very small increments. When treatment A is better than treatment B, whether it's first line, second line setting, usually those survival curves are pretty close together. Usually the hazard rate is somewhere around 0.8, 0.85, statistically significant. We're happy that there's an advance, but it's certainly not dramatic. With this randomized trial of nivolumab versus docetaxel in the second-line setting of patients with squamous cell lung cancer, the Data Safety Monitoring Committee was compelled to recommend early closure of the trial because of such a substantial difference. The hazard rate for overall survival favoring nivolumab is 0.59. We just don't see that in lung cancer, and certainly not in squamous cell cancer. So oddly enough, the tumors that have the highest mutational load, that are the most molecularly dirty, perhaps those are the diseases in which drugs like PD-1 inhibitors will be the most active. These drugs are amazing. So we've participated in a study with another PD-1 inhibitor. I won't name the drug because this data hasn't been reported out yet. But this is one of those less common tumor protocols where all these less common tumors are allowed onto the trial, like mesothelioma and esophageal cancer and carcinoid tumors. And I can tell you, in our experience, we have nice responses in a patient with mesothelioma and in a patient with esophageal cancer. These are heavily pretreated patients. And you're seeing these really nice responses. So these are very exciting times. But this drug was definitely a lifesaver in a patient that I describe here. She's a 44-year-old female. She's a heavy smoker. She presented with bulky disease in her abdomen, including in her adrenal gland and in her liver, bulky disease in her chest. This was requiring her to be on oxygen. She was very weak and tired. She got treated with carboplatin and gemcitabine, and she blew right through that. And she probably did not have a life expectancy of more than maybe 6 weeks. And we treated her with nivolumab, and it's a treatment that's given intravenously every 2 weeks. So I saw her back 2 weeks later, and mind you, this is a patient who needed additional IV fluids a couple of times just to maintain some good hydration. 2 weeks later, she seemed to be doing a little bit better. 2 weeks after that, she was eating better and gaining weight. 2 weeks after that, she was reducing her pain medicine. I knew something good was happening. And at her first scan, which was after 4 treatments or 8 weeks, her liver mets, which were probably 6 or 8 liver mets the size of quarters, became pinpoint size. This mass in her abdomen, and it wasn't in her adrenal glands or in her liver, it was just sort of located densely in her abdomen, which had measured about 12 centimeters in size, had become about 2 centimeters in size. And she just had, it was almost a Lazarus-like effect. And when you see something like that in somebody with squamous cell cancer who's got chemo-refractory disease, it's an attention getter. So I think we'll all see responses like that, and it gives our patients hope.
What's her current situation? Did she have any tolerability issues?
No. And so we've now treated 30 patients at our center with nivolumab. And one of my concerns, not being a melanoma doctor, I had never used a PD-1 inhibitor. And I knew the potential side effects of these drugs. And, you know, in our patient population, they tend to be older and have comorbidities and smoking. I was fearful of pneumonitis and colitis and hepatitis and rash and fevers and arthralgias and all these things. And I won't say this is a totally benign drug. Certainly it has side effects, but these patients that I have treated so far have tolerated it remarkably well. I'm not even sure I've seen a grade 2. I'm certain I haven't seen a grade 3 side effect. Does that mean I'm not going to see them? Of course we're going to see these in patients. And these trials do specifically select out for patients who might have those types of toxicities. So anybody who has an autoimmune illness, for instance, should not receive this. Somebody who has had prior pneumonitis should not receive this. So the selection criteria does help reduce the side effect profile, I imagine. Having said that, I'm pretty impressed.
She's now how far out?
She's about 6 months into this, and she's off oxygen. She's on minimal pain medicines. Her performance status is between 0 and 1. She's gaining weight. She looks wonderful. I saw her as recently as 1 or 2 weeks ago.
Going back to the data itself, what were the fraction of people who had long-lasting objective responses like this patient?
So it appears, and again, all that data has not been reported yet. In fact, to my knowledge, the data has not been reported at a public meeting. They did show their survival curves, though, which are very impressive. That's where I knew the hazard rate for survival was 0.59. But from other studies that we have, it appears that 20% of the responders respond for greater than 2 years.
And what's your take? I mean, this trial came out, but there's also a lot of evidence accumulating in non-squamous tumors. How do you think this is going to play out? Do you think basically you're going to see similar response rates in both histologies, or do you think there'll be a difference?
I think it's probably going to be similar. So the original studies, of course, included patients of all histologies. Responses are seen in all histologies. And of the 30 patients that we have treated, the majority do have adenocarcinoma. And my impression is that the activity is similar. We'll see. But if I had to make my best guess, I would say it's going to be comparable.
What about the use of these agents in the first line setting? Obviously, there are trials looking at that. But just seeing a patient like this and knowing how limited the benefits are with chemotherapy, as is her case, if you could, would you want to give it first line?
Absolutely. As you know, there are randomized trials with both pembrolizumab and nivolumab, single agent versus chemotherapy in the first line setting. If nivolumab is this much better than docetaxel in the second line setting, I don't think it's illogical to think that these drugs will be better than chemotherapy in the first line setting. The issue would be how to use it. Is it going to be better to combine it with chemotherapy? Should we use it as maintenance therapy? Should we use it as a single agent and then add chemotherapy at the time of disease progression? Do we use it as a single agent and then when patients progress, stop it and go to chemotherapy? All these are unanswered questions. And I think the first step is let's see what the first line data shows. I'm optimistic based upon what we saw in the second line setting, but nothing beats data.
Did this lady have a PD-1 assay done? And what do we know right now about the relationship between these assays and benefit?
Well, that's a hot topic right now. And some of the studies are requiring PD-L1 positivity as an enrollment criteria. Others are not. The challenges are, what assay do you use and how do you define positivity? We know from prior trials with nivolumab, for instance, that patients respond who are reportedly PD-L1 negative. We know this in melanoma as well. Not all patients that respond have PD-L1 positivity. So it's controversial right now whether to exclude patients on that basis or not. And also, if we're going to require PD-L1 positivity, what's the assay? How do you define positive? I don't have those answers for you today. No one has those answers. The other issue is whether PD-L1 is really the biomarker. I don't have that answer. People who know more about immunotherapy than I do tell me that they think that there will probably be other biomarkers, other antigens, other inflammatory markers, infiltrating T cells. There recently was a publication in the New England Journal of Medicine looking at a population of patients with melanoma that looked at the antigens of the T cells in the neighboring area. So I don't know.
I'm just kind of curious at a personal level, what it was like to take care of this lady. What it was like to see her scan? What it was like to see her get better?
Honestly, without overstating it, it's why you want to become a doctor. It's such a wonderful experience to share with the patient. And, you know, as an oncologist, you see so much suffering. You see so many people die, and it is tough. And I'm not fooling myself that these are cures. The patient understands that, you know, this may be for a limited time, but it's very special. And I don't think it's overstating it to say this is why we become doctors. We hope to help people in this way. This is why we're so involved in clinical research. This is why I'm such an advocate for new therapies and having people enrolled and participate in clinical trials. And these are incredibly interesting times. The prospects for therapeutic gain have never been greater than what we have right now. Years ago, when you studied drug A versus drug B, you were pretty sure you knew what the limitations were. You hoped there was a small difference. I think our expectations and our goals are set higher now.
One final question. A lot of these people are going to end up getting chemotherapy. A lot of them won't respond to immunotherapy. And I'm curious where you are today. I see this lady got a carbo-gem. There are investigators who favor nab-paclitaxel in squamous cell. And I'm kind of curious what your thoughts are. And also with the emergence of immune therapy, whether or not having to give a corticosteroid is of any benefit.
Yeah, you bring up a very good point, because when you give steroids with chemotherapy, you kill T cells. And this is exactly how the PD-1 inhibitors work, by helping activate T cells to be able to interact with the cancer cells. So you don't want to kill the T cells at the same time. I have used nab-paclitaxel. It's quite an active drug, particularly in squamous cell cancer. We actually have a Hoosier Cancer Research Network trial that will open shortly, looking at carboplatin plus nab-paclitaxel plus pembrolizumab. So I think it's a very good option for patients. I think your point about how we combine drugs with immunotherapy, in which the chemotherapy drugs require corticosteroids, is a very interesting one and does call into question the timing of when you should give an immunotherapy. Certainly giving it the same day as you give a chemo drug and a steroid may not be the best timing.
That's interesting, because I'd heard about ipilimumab in chemotherapy, hadn't heard about anti-PD-1 in chemotherapy. What's the rationale there?
Well, you know, you could look at it as a simple rationale that drug A plus drug B may be better than drug A alone. But there are a number of preclinical rationales that suggest that you can get at least additive activity. The other major issue here is how we combine it with radiation therapy. Radiation therapy is a wonderful inflammatory stimulant. It's an incredible activator of T cells. This is why we get pneumonitis and esophagitis and colitis, for instance. So these drugs are going to be rationally studied in patients after radiation therapy as well. There is a phase 1 study at MD Anderson that is looking to incorporate a PD-1 inhibitor given concurrently with radiation therapy. That type of approach does make me a bit nervous. There are 3 trials that are looking at consolidation PD-1 inhibitors after chemo radiation in stage 3 lung cancer. AstraZeneca's drug with the MedImmune molecule is being tested right now in a phase 3 trial. Patients get chemo radiation, and then if they don't progress, they're randomized to the MedImmune drug versus not as consolidation. We have a Hoosier Cancer Research Network trial that just opened, in which patients get chemo radiation, and then 4 to 8 weeks later, if they haven't progressed, they get pembrolizumab. And my understanding is Bristol-Myers Squibb is working on a trial with nivolumab in the consolidation setting. And again, the rationale is that the prior therapy serves as sort of a T-cell stimulator.
So continuing with the theme of squamous cell, we can talk a little bit about your 65-year-old man.
So this is a 65-year-old gentleman with a history of tobacco use, and he presents with a lung mass and adrenal mets. His biopsy does show squamous cell cancer. He gets carboplatin and paclitaxel and has a minor response, but it's short-lived, and after 3 months, he does have progression of disease. So now the challenge is, what do we do in the second-line setting? And there are really 3 options outside of a clinical trial to consider. One could consider standard docetaxel. One could consider docetaxel plus ramucirumab. That combination demonstrated improved survival compared to docetaxel alone. Or one could consider the new indication with nivolumab. So there are options here. I think in a very fit patient who's motivated, either nivolumab or ramucirumab plus docetaxel might be favored over docetaxel alone. In a more borderline patient, perhaps you might go with a more conservative approach.
And what did you decide to do?
So this patient, I did offer nivolumab, but it is interesting that we now have three separate, and actually if you count erlotinib, which I rarely give a second-line therapy in squamous cell, so if we don't count that for just a second, we now have three options to offer the patient. The reason why I chose nivolumab is the magnitude of difference against docetaxel was much greater than what we saw when you simply add ramucirumab. Ramucirumab plus docetaxel is statistically better than docetaxel. Again, it's more along the lines of what we typically see. The improvement in median survival, you know, was 2 months, and the hazard rates are in the 0.8, 0.85 range. But that nivolumab curve separates and keeps separating against docetaxel. A hazard rate of 0.59 is quite impressive. And also the tolerability of it. And in context of this patient, they did get a taxane first line, and they did not have an overly durable response. So it makes even more logical sense to me to go away from docetaxel and to go towards nivolumab. I have used ramucirumab with docetaxel. I think it's a reasonable combination. I think it's reasonably tolerated, although the side effects are a little bit higher compared to docetaxel alone.
From your point of view, is it similar to using Bev?
My bias is that it is. In the docetaxel plus ramucirumab trial, the vast majority of patients did not get Bev in the first line setting, although about 10 or 15% did. We know that chemotherapy plus VEGF inhibitors improve response rate and improve progression-free survival compared to chemo alone. We've seen this with a number of drugs, including nintedanib and vandetanib, and even with bevacizumab in prior trials. What made this trial unique with ramucirumab was it was the first trial that actually showed an overall survival difference.
I was wondering about the tolerability, though, of ramucirumab. Is the side effect profile and the issues similar to Bev?
I do think that they are similar. I've had much less personal experience with ramucirumab. I actually have treated patients with GE junction tumors and gastric cancer with ramucirumab more than I've treated lung cancer. So my personal experience is not great in lung cancer. My general impressions are that the issues are similar. Have you seen differently in the data you've looked at?
No, that's why I was asking you. It kind of sounds, you know, hypertension, you know, not very much from a quality of life issue. Of course, we've been hearing about it in gastric for the last couple years. That's what I'd heard. I was curious if that's what you actually have seen in the few patients you've treated, just like hypertension and not much quality of life issues.
Yeah, that has been what I've seen.
What's his current situation?
He's actively on nivolumab, and he's only gotten a couple of infusions. It's too early to know.
And if he were to develop disease progression, which I guess is the most likely scenario, really, in a fairly short period of time, on the nivolumab, what would you do then?
If his performance status allowed, I would offer him docetaxel with or without ramucirumab. We would go over the pros and cons of this.
Any thoughts about using, you know, an anti-angiogenic agent, specifically ramucirumab, targeting the VEGF axis in view of the fact that we don't use bevacizumab in squamous cell, at least when there is disease in the lung? How comfortable are you that hemoptysis is not going to be a problem?
All I can do is rely upon the data that was reported from the randomized study, which did allow patients with squamous cell histology, of course, along with adenocarcinoma histology, and they did not have significant issues with that.